an event forgotten as soon as it had happened. There was parking, a metal detector, a clerk, a back staircase instead of the elevator, another clerk, a glimpsed low-ceilinged room with pews like a church on either side of an aisle, a church for the mundane, a service for those who claim not guilty. Adam tried to soothe himself by telling himself that people worked here every day. This was nothing extraordinary to them. There was nothing special about this building. But the old mold and glue smell of it, the feeling of threadbare carpet beneath his feet, the sickly, uneven light of the fluorescence overhead, all of it felt alien. All of it burdened his senses with how this day was like no other. He was going to be sick or faint. Was his father in the building yet? It was a closed courtroom for juvenile cases, so the only people in the room so far were the staff, clerks, lawyers, bailiffs. Adam turned over the possible outcomes in his head. If he lost, he knew academically that the court couldn't make him return home. He was 18 and free to go and fail or succeed in life apart from his family. But would this linger on his record then? A boy who had spuriously taken his father to court? How ugly that would look. How base. He imagined Gansey's father interpreting, familial squabbling of the lower classes. This is how the low stayed low, he would say. Infighting and drinking, daytime TV and Walmart everyday low prices. He couldn't quite feel invested in winning either because he wasn't sure what it would look like. It was possible that his father would go back to jail. If he did, could his mother pay the bills? He shouldn't care, but he couldn't make himself stop. Adam felt as if he were playing pretend in his good suit. But you are just one of them, white trash in diamonds. There was his father. He was in a jacket with some local company's logo on the back and his company polo shirt. Adam prayed for some sort of clarity, to see his father as everyone else saw him, instead of as, "Dad, it's Adam." "There's still time for you to tell the truth," Robert Parrish said. Adam's mother had not come. Adam's fingers were numb. "Even if I lose," he thought weakly, "he can't have me back, so it won't matter. It will only be this hour of humiliation, and then it will be over." He wished he had never done this. "All right, then," said the judge. His face was a memory that vanished the minute Adam blinked. Cabe's water stole him away for a blissful second, leaves curled against his throat, and then released him. How desperately Adam wanted to cling to Cabe's water. Strange as it was familiar and on his side. He had been wrong to come here alone. Why did he care if Gansey and Ronan saw this? They already knew. They knew everything about him. What a lie unknowable was. The only person who didn't know Adam was himself. What a proud idiot you have been, Adam Parrish.
"Are there any witnesses for this case?" the judge asked.
There were not. Adam didn't look at his father.
"Then I guess we shall begin."
A hissing sound came from the bailiff beside the judge, a voice through his radio. The bailiff leaned his head to listen, then muttered something back to the speaker. Coming close to the judge, he said,
"Your Honor, Bailiff Miley says there are some witnesses for the case outside, if it's not too late for them to come in."
"The door is already closed, is it not?"
"It is."
The judge peered at his watch.
"They are certainly for the Parrish case."
"Bailiff Miley seems to think they are."
The judge smiled with some private humor. This was some long-running joke the others weren't privy to.
"Far be it from me to doubt him. Send them in, and I'll decide whether to allow them."
Adam miserably wondered which of the neighbors were coming to his father's defense.
"In an hour, this will be over. You will never have to do it again. All you have to do is survive."
The door cracked open. Adam didn't want to look, but he did anyway. In the hall stood Richard Campbell Gansey III in his school uniform and overcoat and scarf and gloves, looking like someone from another world. Behind him was Ronan Lynch, his damn tie knotted right for once and his shirt tucked in. Humiliation and joy warred furiously inside Adam. Gansey strode between the pews as Adam's father stared at him. He went directly to the bench, straight up to the judge. Now that he stood directly beside Adam, not looking at him, Adam could see that he was a little out of breath. Ronan behind him was as well. They had run. For him. Removing his right glove, Gansey shook hands with the judge. "Judge Harris," he said warmly.
"Mr. Gansey," said Judge Harris, "have you found that king of yours yet?"
"Not just yet. Have you finished that terrace yet?"
"Not just yet," Harris replied. "What's your business with this case?"
"Ronan Lynch here was at the incident," Gansey said. "I thought his side of the story might be worthy. And I've been friends with Adam since day one here in Henrietta, and I'm glad to see this miserable business over. I'd like to be a character witness if I could."
"That sounds reasonable," Harris said.
"I object," Robert Parrish exclaimed.
Gansey turned to Adam finally. He was still wearing his glorious, kingly face. Richard Campbell Gansey III, White Knight. But his eyes were uncertain. "Is this okay?" Was it okay? Adam had turned down so many offers of help from Gansey. Money for school, money for food, money for rent. Pity and charity, Adam had thought. For so long he'd wanted Gansey to see him as an equal, but it was possible that all this time the only person who needed to see that was Adam. Now he could see that it wasn't charity Gansey was offering. He was just truth and something else. Friendship of the unshakable kind. Friendship you could swear on. That could be busted nearly to breaking and come back stronger than before. Adam held out his right hand, and Gansey clasped it in a handshake like they were men, because they were men.
"All right," Harris reported. "Let's get this case underway."
39. Adam didn't normally take anyone with him when he did Cabe's Waters work. He trusted his skills on his own. His emotions he trusted on his own. He could hurt no one in an empty room. No one could hurt him. He was unknowable. Except that he wasn't. So he asked Blue Sergeant to come with him when he finally went to do what Cabe's Water had asked him to do weeks before. He didn't tell her in case it didn't work, but he thought that if he brought her with him, Cabe's Water might help them find Mora. Now he waited in the car at a faded gas station outside of Henrietta. He couldn't tell if the pulse in his palms was his heartbeat or the ley line. "I know what you mean," Noah said from the back seat. He was draped over the passenger headrest like a sweater with a body still in it. Adam had nearly forgotten he was there because he hadn't been invited. Not because he was unwanted, but because he was dead, and the deceased couldn't be counted on to show up at specific times. "Did you just reply to my thoughts?"
"I don't think so."
Adam couldn't remember if he'd spoken out loud. He didn't think he had. The car rocked as a farm truck trundled by on the highway. Everything about this area was worn. The gas station was a survivor from decades past, with tin signs in the window and chickens for sale behind it. The farm across the road was faded but charming, like a yellowed newspaper. He turned Greenmantle's blackmail over in his mind. It had to be bulletproof. He hadn't told Gansey. He hadn't told Blue. He'd convinced Ronan of it and brought the gray man into it, but in the end, it was all on him if Greenmantle exploded in their faces.
"I think it's ready," Noah said.
"Stop that. Stop. It's creepy." He shot a glance to Noah in the rearview mirror and regretted it. The dead boy was more frightening in reflections, much less living. Noah knew it. He ducked out of the mirror's view. From outside the car, Blue's voice rose. "How would you feel if I reduced you to your legs?" Adam and Noah craned to look out the back window. Blue's voice came again. "No, no. How about you see it my way? How about you don't reduce me to a commodity, and then when I ask you not to, tell me it's a compliment and I should be glad for it?" Noah's mouth made an ooh shape. "Yeah," Adam agreed, climbing out. Blue stood a few feet away. She wore a big boxy t-shirt, teal shorts, combat boots, and socks that came up over her knees. Only 4 inches of bare skin were visible,
but they were a really nice 4 inches. An old man wearing a seed cap was saying,
"Little lady, one day you'll remember the days people told you that you had nice legs as a good memory."
Adam braced for the explosion. It was nails and dynamite.
Good memory? Oh, I wish I were as ignorant as you. What happiness. There are girls who kill themselves over negative body image, and you...
"Is there a problem here?" Adam broke in. The man seemed relieved. People were always pleased to see clean, muted Adam, the deferential southern voice of reason.
"Your girlfriend's quite a firecracker."
Adam stared at the man. Blue stared at Adam. He wanted to tell her it wasn't worth it, that he'd grown up with this sort of man and knew they were untrainable, but then she'd throw the thermos at Adam's head and probably slap that guy in the mouth. It was amazing that she and Ronan didn't get along better because they were different brands of the same impossible stuff.
"Sir," Adam started. Blue's eyebrows spiked. "I think maybe your mama didn't teach you how to talk to women."
The old man shook his head at Adam, like in pity. Adam added, "And she's not my girlfriend." Blue flashed him a brilliant look of approval, and then she got into the car with a dramatic door slam Ronan would have approved of.
"Look, kid,"
the old man started. Adam interrupted.
"Your fuel door's open, by the way."
He climbed back into his little shitty car, the one Ronan called the Hyundai Iota. He felt heroic for no good reason. Blue simmered righteously as they pulled out of the station. For a few moments, there was nothing but the labored sound of the little car's breathing. Then Noah said,
"You do have nice legs, though."
Blue swung at him. A helpless laugh escaped Adam, and she hit his shoulder, too.
"Did you get the water, at least?" he asked.
She sloshed the thermos to demonstrate success.
"I also brought some jet. It's supposed to be good protection while you're scrying."
"We're scrying?" Noah sat up straight. Adam struggled to explain.
"Cave's water speaks one language and I speak another. I can get the broad idea from reading the cards, but it's harder to get the specifics of how to fix the alignment. So I'm scrying. I do it all the time. It's just efficient, Noah."
"An efficient way to get your naked soul stolen by forces of raw evil, maybe," Noah said.
Blue exchanged a look with Adam.
"I don't believe in raw evil,"
Noah said.
"It doesn't care if you believe in it."
She turned in her seat to face him.
"I don't normally like to point out when you're being creepy, but you are."
The dead boy retreated farther into the back seat. The air warmed marginally as he did.
"He already called me creepy today."
"Tell me more about the aligning stuff," Blue said to Adam. "Tell me why it wants you to."
"I don't understand how it matters."
She made a noise of profound exasperation.
"Even putting aside every single spiritual consideration or mythological consideration or anything that actually means anything, you're manipulating this massive energy source that seems to communicate directly into your head in a different language, and that, to me, seems like something I would have a lot of questions about if I were you."
"I don't want to talk about it."
"But I do. You're driving all the way out here and you don't even ask why?"
Adam didn't reply, because his reply wouldn't have been civil. His silence, however, seemed to be worse. She snapped, "If you didn't want to talk, I don't know why you asked me if I wanted to come."
"Maybe I shouldn't have."
"Right. Who wants someone who thinks along with them?" He reined himself in with effort. With only a little barbed wire in his tone, he said,
"I just want to get this done."
"Just put me out here. I'll walk back." He slammed on the brakes.
"Don't think I won't."
"Do it, then." She already had her hand on the door handle. "Guys," Noah wailed.
The best and worst thing about Blue Sargent was that she meant what she said. She really would walk herself back to Henrietta if he stopped now.
He grimaced at her. She grimaced back.
"Don't fight with Blue. Don't fight with Gansey."
With a sigh, he sped up again. Blue got herself back together and then turned on the radio. Adam hadn't even realized the ancient tape deck worked, but after a hissing few seconds, a tape inside jangled a tune. Noah began to sing along at once.
"Squash one, squash two."
Adam pawed for the radio at the same time as Blue. The tape ejected with enough force that Noah stretched a hand to catch it. That song,
What are you doing with that in your player? Demanded Blue. Do you listen to that recreationally? How did that song escape from the internet?
Noah cackled and showed them the cassette. It boasted a handmade label marked with Ronan's handwriting. Parrish's Hondayota Alone Time. The other side was a shitbox sing-along.
Play it, play it, Noah said gaily, waving the tape.
Noah, take that away from him, Adam said.
Ahead of them, the entrance for Skyline Drive loomed.
Adam was ready this time. He opened his wallet as they coasted closer. Inside nestled precisely $15.
Blue handed over a $5.
My contribution.
There was a pause.
He took it.
At the window, he exchanged their combined funds for a map, which he gave back to Blue. As he headed into a slanted parking area shortly beyond the entrance, he uncertainly examined his pride for damage and was surprised to find none.
Is this the right place? She asked. Do you need our $15 map?
Adam said,
I'll know in a second. We can get out.
Before them, the ground dropped sharply into a bottomless ravine. Behind them, the mountains ascended darkly. The air was clouded with the pleasant and dangerous scent of wood smoke. Somewhere, one of these autumn mountains was on fire. Adam squinted until he found its source, smoke shrouding a distant peak. From this far away, it seemed more magical than threatening. Blue and Noah horsed around as Adam retrieved his tarot cards. Squaring his feet so that he could better feel the line's pulse, he placed a random card on the warm hood. His unfocused eye skipped over the image, a black-smudged knight on horseback carrying a vine-wrapped staff, and began to remake it into something wordless and dreamy. Sight was replaced with sensation, a vertiginous feeling of travel, climbing, rightness. He covered the image with his hand until he got his eyes back, and then he put the card away.
Knight of Wands, Blue asked him.
Already Adam couldn't remember what the card had really been.
Was it?
Now who's creepy?
Noah asked. Adam shouldered his backpack and headed toward the trailhead.
Come on, it's this way.
The rocky narrow trail was dusted with crumbled leaves. The ground fell away abruptly on one side and rose as precipitously on the other. Adam was hyper-aware of the massive boulders that jutted into the trail. Beneath a furring of mint-green lichen, the stones felt cool and alive, wild conductors of the ley line. He led Noah and Blue upward until they came to a confusion of boulders. Stepping off the trail, Adam climbed alongside them, finding footholds on jutting stones and exposed tree branches. The big blue stones were tumbled onto one another like a giant's playset.
Yes, this is it.
He peered into a man-sized crevice.
Blue said, snakes? Nests? Bears?
Protected National Park, Noah said, darkly funny, and then, with unexpected valiance,
I'll go in first. They can't hurt me.
He looked smudgy and insubstantial as he slid inside.
There was silence, silence.
Blue squinted.
Noah?
From inside the crevice came a great rustling flurry. All at once, a large puff of oak leaves exploded from the opening, startling both Blue and Adam. Noah reappeared. He plucked 4.5 oak leaves out of Blue's spiky hair and blew some leaf crumbs from the bridge of Adam's nose.
It's safe.
Adam was glad to have them with him. Inside was dim but not dark. Light came from the entrance and also from below where the rocks were stacked imperfectly. In the middle of the small space was a large boulder the size of a desk or an altar. The surface was worn and cupped. He remembered or recognized it from his insight in the garage. He felt a little shake of nerves or anticipation. It was strange to do this with an audience. He didn't quite know what he looked like from the outside.
Pour the water in there, Blue.
Blue ran a hand over the stone to clear out debris.
Oh!
Retrieving a black stone from her pocket, she placed it by the indentation. Then she slowly filled it with water. The shallow pool reflected the dark ceiling. Noah backed well away from it, making sure he wasn't reflected. His fear sucked the warmth from the space. Blue stretched a hand to him, but he shook his head. So she stayed by Adam, shoulder pressed to his, and Adam found he was glad for this, too. He couldn't remember the last time someone had touched him, and it was strangely grounding. After a second, he realized that part of it was probably the fact of Blue's ability, too, amplifying whatever part of Cave's water he was tied to. They eyed the water. He had done this before, but never like this, surrounded by rock. It felt like there was someone else in the room with him. He didn't want to admit that he was already intimidated by the dark pool even before anything supernatural had happened. Neither of them said anything for a few minutes. Finally, Blue whispered, "It's like if someone said to you, 'Nice sweater, dude,' when you were in your Aglimby uniform." "What?" "I wanted you to know why I got so angry at that old guy. I've been trying to think of a way to explain it. I know you don't get it, but that's why." It was true that he hadn't understood the fuss at the gas station, really, beyond the fact that she was bothered, and he didn't like for her to be bothered. But she was right about the sweater, too. People assumed things based on the Aglimby sweater or blazer all the time. He'd done it himself, still did it. "I get it," he whispered back. He wasn't sure why they were whispering, but he did feel better now. More normal. They were in control here. "It's simplifying." "Exactly." She took a deep breath. "Okay, what now?" "I'm going to look in and focus," Adam said. "I might zone out." Noah whimpered. Blue, however, sounded practical. "What do you want us to do if you zone out?" "I don't reckon you should do anything. I don't really know what it will look like from the outside. I guess use your judgment if something seems wrong." Noah hugged his arms around himself. Leaning over the pool, Adam saw his face. He hadn't noticed that he didn't look like everyone else until he got to high school when everyone else started noticing. He didn't know if he was good-looking or bad-looking, only that he was different-looking. It was up to interpretation whether the strangeness of his face was beautiful or ugly. He waited for his features to disappear, to smudge into a sensation. But all he saw was his Henrietta Dirt face with its pulled-down, thin mouth. He wished he wouldn't grow up to look like his parents' combined genes. "I don't think it's working," he said. But Blue didn't reply, and after half a heartbeat, Adam realized that his mouth hadn't moved in the reflection when he spoke. His face just stared back, eyebrows drawn into suspicion and worry. His thoughts churned up inside him, silt clouding a pool of water. Humans were so circular. They lived the same slow cycles of joy and misery over and over, never learning. Every lesson in the universe had to be taught billions of times, and it never stuck. "How arrogant we are," Adam thought, "to deliver babies who can't walk or talk or feed themselves. How sure we are that nothing will destroy them before they can take care of themselves. How fragile they were, how easily abandoned and neglected and beaten and hated. Prey animals were born afraid." He had not known to be born afraid, but he'd learned. Maybe it was good that the world forgot every lesson, every good and bad memory, every triumph and failure, all of it dying with each generation. Perhaps this cultural amnesia spared them all. Perhaps if they remembered everything, hope would die instead.
"Outside yourself," Persephone's voice reminded him.
It was difficult to tear himself away. There was a strange, hideous comfort to wearing the edges off his interior. With effort, he recalled Caveswater. He felt along the field of the energy in his mind. Somewhere there would be a fray or dispersion, some ailment he could cure. There it was. Far down the ley line, the energy was fractured. If he concentrated, he could even see why. A highway had been cut into a mountain, gouging out rock and breaking the natural line of the ley. Now it sputtered unevenly as it leapt across and under the highway. If Adam could realign a few of the charged stones at the top of this mountain, it would cause a chain reaction that would eventually make the line dig underground beneath the highway, joining the frayed ends again. He asked, "Why do you want me to do this?"
"Rogo, Alakuam, Alakuid."
He didn't really expect an answer,
but he heard a babble of speech, incomprehensible but for one word. Grey Warren. Ronan, who effortlessly spoke Gabe's Waters language, not Adam, who struggled. But not in the Aglinby courtyard. He hadn't struggled then. There hadn't been a language, just him and Cabeswater. Not Ronan, Adam said. Me. I'm the one who's doing this for you. Tell me. Show me. Images barraged him. Connections darted electric. Veins, roots, forked lightning, tributaries, branches. Vines snaked around trees, herds of animals, drops of water running together. I don't understand. Fingers twined together, shoulder leaned on shoulder, fist bumping fist, hand dragging Adam up from the dirt. Cabeswater rifled madly through Adam's own memories and flashed them through his mind. It hurled images of Gansey, Ronan, Noah, and Blue so fast that Adam couldn't keep up with all of them. Then the grid of lightning blasted across the world, an illuminated grid of energy. Adam still did not understand, and then he did. There was more than one Cabeswater, or more of whatever it was. How many? He didn't know. How alive was it? He didn't know that either. Did it think? Was it an alien? Did it die? Was it good? Was it right? He didn't know. But he knew there was more than one, and this one stretched its fingers out as hard as it could to reach the other. The enormity of the world grew and grew inside Adam, and he didn't know if he could hold it. He was just a boy. Was he meant to know this? They had transformed Henrietta already by waking this ley line and strengthening Cabeswater. What would a world look like with more forests woken all over it? Would it tear itself apart with crackling electricity and magic? Or was this a pendulum swing, a result of hundreds of years of sleep? How many kings slept? I can't do this. This is too big. I was not made for this. Doubt suddenly tore blackly through him. It was a thing, this doubt. It had weight and body and legs. What? Adam thought he said it out loud, but he couldn't quite remember how doing was different than imagining. He'd wandered too far from his own body. Again, he felt that doubtful thing reaching at him, speaking to him. It didn't believe in his power here. It knew he was a pretender. Adam dragged at words. Are you Cabeswater? Are you Glendower? But words seemed like the wrong medium for this place. Words were for mouths, and he didn't have one anymore. He stretched through the world. He couldn't seem to find his way back to the cave. He was in an ocean sinking darkly. He was alone, except for this thing, and he thought it hated him, or wanted him, or both. He longed to see it. Seeing it would be the worst thing. Adam flailed in the black. All directions looked the same. Something was crawling on his skin. He was in a cavern, crouched. The ceiling was low and the stalactites touched his back. When he reached to touch the wall, it felt real under his fingers, or like it was real and he wasn't. Adam. He turned to the voice, and it was a woman he recognized but couldn't name. He was too far from his thoughts. Even though he was certain it had been her voice, she didn't look at him. She was crouched in the cavern beside him, eyebrows knitted in concentration, a fist pressed to her lips. A man knelt adjacent to her, but everything about his folded-over, lanky body suggested that he wasn't in communication with the woman. They were both motionless as they faced a door set into the stone. Adam, go. The door told him to touch it. It described the satisfaction of the handle turning beneath his hand. It promised an understanding of the blackness inside him if he pushed it open. It pulsed in him, the hunger, the ascending desire. He had never wanted anything so badly. He was in front of it. He didn't remember crossing the distance, but somehow he had. The door was dark red and carved with roots and knots and crowns. The handle was oily black.
He had come so far from his body that he couldn't imagine how to even begin going back. The door needs three to open. Go.
Adam crouched motionless, fingers braced against the stone, afraid and desirous.
Somewhere far away, he felt his body getting older.
Adam, go.
I can't, he thought. I'm lost.
Adam! Adam Parrish!
He came to in a fury of pain. His face felt wet. His hand felt wet. His veins felt too full of blood. Noah's voice rose. Why did you cut him so deep?
I didn't measure, Blue said. Adam, you jerk, say something.
Pain made every possible response meaner than it would have been otherwise. Instead, he hissed and rocked himself upright, gripping one hand with the other. His surroundings were slowly representing themselves to him. He'd forgotten that they'd crawled in between these boulders. Noah crouched an inch away, eye on Adam. Blue stood a little bit behind him. Things were starting to come together. He was very aware of his fingers and mouth and skin and eyes and himself. He couldn't remember ever being so glad to be Adam Parrish. His eyes focused on the pink switchblade knife in Blue's hand. You cut me? He said.
Noah's shoulders slumped in relief at his voice.
Adam studied his hand. A clean slice marred the back of it. It was bleeding like nobody's business, but it didn't hurt badly unless he moved it. The knife must have been very sharp.
Noah touched the edge of the wound with his freezing fingers, and Adam slapped him away. He struggled to remember everything the voice had just said, but already it was sliding out of his head like a dream.
Had there even been words? Why did he think there had been words?
I didn't know what else to try to get you back, Blue admitted. Noah said to cut you.
He was confused by the switchblade. It seemed to represent a different side of her, a side that he had not thought existed. His brain wearied when he tried to fit it in with the rest of her.
Why did you stop me? What was I doing?
She said nothing at the same time that Noah said dying.
Your face went sort of empty, she went on, and then your eyes just stopped.
Blinking? Moving?
I tried to get you back.
And then you stopped breathing, Noah said. He slunk to his feet.
I told you it was a bad idea, and nobody ever listens to me.
Oh, we'll be fine. Noah, you're such a worrywart, and next thing you know, you're in some kind of death thrall. Nobody ever says, Noah, you know what? You were right. Thanks for saving my life, because being dead would suck. They just always
stop, Adam interrupted. I'm trying to remember everything that happened.
There had been someone important. Three. A door. A woman he recognized. It was fading. Everything except for the terror.
Next time I'll let you die, Blue said. You forget, Adam, when you're pulling your special snowflake act where I grew up. Do you know what the phrase is for when someone helps you during a ritual or a reading? It's thank you. You shouldn't have brought us if you wanted to do it alone.
He remembered this. He had been lost, which meant that if he had come alone, he would have been dead now.
Sorry, he said. I was being sort of a dick.
Noah replied. We weren't going to say it.
I was, Blue said.
Then they climbed to the top of the mountain, and as the sun blasted them from above, found the stones Adam had seen in the scrying pool. It took all of their combined strength to shove the rocks just a few bare inches. Adam didn't know how he would have managed this part without help either. Possibly he was doing it wrong, and there was a better, more proper magician way. He left bloody fingerprints on the rock, but there was something satisfying about that. I was here. I exist. I'm alive because I bleed. He hadn't stopped being thankful for his body.
Hello, Adam Parrish's formerly chapped hands. I'm happy to have you.
They knew the precise moment they'd solved the alignment because Noah said, ah, and stretched his fingers up to the air. For a few minutes, anyway, he was silhouetted against the livid sky, and there was no difference between him and Blue and Adam. There was nothing to say that he was anything less than fully living. As the winds buffeted them, Noah slung a comradely arm around Blue's shoulders and another around Adam's and pulled them to him. They staggered back toward the trail. Blue's arm was linked around the back of Noah, and her fingers grabbed Adam's t-shirt so that they were one creature, a drunken six-legged animal. Adam's hand was throbbing with the beat of his heart. Probably he was going to bleed to death on the way back down the mountain, but he was okay with that. Suddenly, with Noah to his side and Blue next to him, three strong, Adam remembered the woman he had seen in the pool. He knew all at once who she was. "Blue," he said, "I saw your mother."
40.
"This is one of my favorite places,"
Persephone said, tipping her rocking chair to and fro with her bare feet, her hair cascaded over the arms.
"It's so homey."
Adam perched on the edge of the rocking chair beside her. He did not much like the place, but he did not say it. She had asked him to meet her here, and she nearly never made the decision of where to meet. She left it up to him, which always felt like a test. It was a strange old general store of the sort that had died everywhere else but was not uncommon around Henrietta. The outside usually looked like this one, a sweeping low porch lined with rocking chairs facing the road, a rutted gravel parking lot, signs for bait and cigarettes in the windows. The inside usually held convenience store foods and brands one had never heard of. T-shirts Adam would not wear, fishing supplies, toys from another decade, and the occasional taxidermied deer head. It was a place that Adam, a hick, found to be populated by people he considered even more hickish. Gansey would probably like it, though. It was one of those places where time seemed irrelevant, especially on an evening like this. Dappled light fuzzing through leaves, starlings calling from the close-strung telephone wires. Old men and old trucks driving slowly past, all of it looking like it could have happened 20 years before.
3,
Persephone said,
is a very strong number.
Lessons with Persephone were an unpredictable thing. He never knew going in what he was going to learn. Sometimes he still hadn't figured it going out. This evening, he wanted to ask her about Mora, but it was hard to ask Persephone a question and get an answer when you wanted it. Usually it worked best if you asked the question right before she was about to say the answer anyway. Like three sleepers?
Sure,
Persephone replied.
Or three nights.
Are there nights? She pointed, drawing his attention to a large crow or raven hopping slowly on the other side of the road. It was hard to say if she thought it was significant or just funny.
There were once. Also, three Jesuses.
This took Adam a moment. Oh, God. You mean God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit? Persephone twirled a small hand.
I always forget the names. There's a three-lady God, too. One's named War, I think, and another one's a baby. I don't know. I forget the details. The three is the important part.
He was better at playing these games than he used to be, better at guessing the connections. You and Mora and Calla. Maybe now was the time to bring it up. She nodded, or rocked, or both.
It's a stable number, 3. 5s and 7s are good, too. But 3 is the best. Things are always growing to 3 or shrinking to 3. Best to start there. 2 is a terrible number. 2 is for rivalry and fighting and murder.
Or marriage, Adam said, thinking.
Same thing,
Persephone replied.
Here's $3. Go inside and get me a cherry cola.
He did so, trying to think the entire time how to ask about using his vision to find Mora. With Persephone, it was possible that that was what they had actually been talking about the entire time. When he returned, he said suddenly, "This is the last time, isn't it?" She continued rocking, but she nodded.
I thought, at first, that you might replace one of us if something ever happened.
It took him a long time to make the sentence make sense, and when he finally did, the surprise kept him from answering for another minute longer. Me?
You're a very good listener.
But I'm... He couldn't think of how to finish the sentence. He finally said, "Leaving?" Even as he said it, he knew it wasn't what he meant. But Persephone just said in her tiny voice,
"But I see now that it could never be. You're like me. We're not really like the others."
"Other what, humans?" "You are unknowable."
He thought of that moment on the mountaintop with him and Blue and Noah, or in the courtroom, him and Ronan and Gansey. He wasn't sure anymore.
"We're really better in our own company,"
Persephone said.
"It makes it hard sometimes for others when they can't understand us."
She was trying to get him to say something, to make some connection, but he wasn't sure what. He said, "Don't tell me Moira is dead." She rocked and rocked. Then she stopped and looked at him with her black, black eyes. The sun eased down behind the tree line, making a black lace of the leaves and a white lace of her hair. Adam's breath caught. He asked in a low voice, "Can you see your own death?"
"Everyone sees it," Persephone said mildly. "Most people make themselves stop looking, though."
"I don't see my own death," Adam said, but even as he said it, he felt the corner of the knowledge bite into him. It was now. It was coming. It had already happened. Somewhere, some when, he was dying.
"Ah, you see," she said.
"That's not the same as knowing how."
"You didn't say how."
What he wanted to say but couldn't because Persephone wouldn't understand was that he was afraid. Not of seeing things like this, but of one day not being able to see everything else. The real, the mundane, the human things. We're not really like the others. But he thought that maybe he was. He thought he must be because he cared deeply about Moira's disappearance and he cared even more deeply about Gansey's death. And now that he knew about these things, he wanted to do something about them. He needed to. He was Cave's water stretching out to others. He took a shaky breath. "Do you know how Gansey dies?" Persephone stuck her tongue out just a little. She didn't seem to notice she was doing it. Then she said,
"Here is $3 more. Go get yourself a cherry cola."
He didn't take the money. He said, "I want to know how long you've known about Gansey." "From the beginning?" "From the beginning. You knew it when he walked in the door for the reading. Were you ever going to tell us?"
"I don't know why I would do such a ridiculous thing. Get your cola."
Adam still didn't take the bills. Bracing his hands on the arms of his rocker, he said, "When I find Glendower, I'm asking him for Gansey's life, and that'll be that." Persephone just looked at him. In his head, Gansey shook and kicked, covered with blood. Only now, it was Ronan's face. Ronan had already died. Gansey was going to die. Somewhere, some when, was this happening? He didn't want to know. He wanted to know. "Tell me then," he said. "Tell me what to do."
"What do you want me to say?"
Adam leapt out of the chair so quickly that it rocked frantically without him. "Tell me how to save him."
"For how long?"
Persephone asked. "Stop," he said. "Stop that. Stop being so zoomed out. I can't look at the big picture all the time, or what's the point? Just tell me how I can keep from killing him." Persephone cocked her head.
"What makes you think you kill him?"
He stared at her, then went back inside for another cherry cola. "Thirsty?" asked the clerk as Adam handed over his money. "The other one was for my friend," Adam said, although he wasn't sure anyone was Persephone's friend.
"Your friend?"
asked the clerk. "Probably." He went back outside and found the porch empty. His rocker was still rocking just a little. The other cherry cola was sitting beside it. "Persephone?" With sudden misgiving, he rushed to the rocker she had been sitting in. He put his hand on the seat. "Cool." He put his hand on the seat of his. "Warm." He craned his neck, looking to see if she was back inside the car. There was nothing. The parking lot was still. Even the bird was gone. "No," he said, though there was no one to hear him. His mind, a mind curiously remade by Cave's water, frantically pulled from everything he knew and felt, everything Persephone had said, every moment since he had arrived.
The sun crept behind the trees.
"No," he said again. The clerk was at the door, locking it for the night. "Wait," Adam said. "Did you see my friend, or did I come here alone?"
She raised one eyebrow.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I know how it sounds. Please, was it just me?"
The clerk hesitated, waiting for the prank. Then she nodded.
Adam's heart felt bottomless. "I need to use your phone, please, ma'am, just for a second."
"Why?"
"Something terrible has happened."
41.
"I'm here," Blue said, whirling in the door of 300 Foxway. She was sweaty and irritable and nervous, torn between hoping for a false alarm and hoping it was important enough to justify begging off in the middle of her Nino shift. Calla met her in the hall as she dropped her bag by the door.
"Come here and help Adam."
"What's wrong with Adam?"
"Nothing," Calla snapped, "besides the usual. He's looking for Persephone."
They reached the reading room door. Inside, Adam sat at the head of the reading room table. He was very still, and his eyes were closed. In front of him was the black scrying bowl from Mara's room. The only light was from three flickering candles. Blue's stomach did something unpleasant. "I don't think this is a good idea," she said. "Last time..."
"I know, he told me," Calla said. "But he's willing to risk it, and it'll be better with three of us."
"Why is he looking for Persephone?"
"He thinks something's wrong with her."
"Where is she? Did she tell you where she went?"
Calla gave Blue a withering look. Of course, Persephone never told anyone anything.
"Okay," Blue said. Calla closed the reading room doors behind her and pointed for Blue to sit beside Adam. Adam opened his eyes. She wasn't sure what to ask him, and he just shook his head a little like he was angry at himself or Persephone or the world. Calla sat opposite and took one of Adam's hands. She ordered Blue.
"You take the other. I'll ground him, and you'll amplify him."
Blue and Adam exchanged a look. They had not held hands since their breakup.
She slid her hand across the table, and he linked his fingers through hers. Gingerly, not pushing the issue, Blue closed her fingers around his hand. Adam said, He stopped. He was looking at the scrying bowl out of the corner of his eye, not dead on.
"You're what?"
Calla said. He finished.
"I'm trusting you guys."
Blue held his hand a little tighter.
Calla said, "We won't let you fall."
The bowl shimmered darkly, and he looked into it. He looked and looked, the candles flickering, and Blue felt the precise moment his body released his soul because the candles went strange in the reflections and his fingers went limp in hers. Blue looked sharply to Calla, but Calla merely remained as she was, his light hand lying in her dark one, her chin tilted up, her eyes cut over to Adam watchfully. His lips moved like he was mumbling to himself, but no sound came out. Blue thought of how she amplified his scrying, forcing him further down into the ether. Adam wandered now, traveling out from his body, unwinding the thread that tied him back to it. Calla hung on to the thread, but Blue pushed on him. Adam's eyebrows furrowed, his lips parted. His eyes were utterly black, the black of the mirrored scrying bowl. Every so often, the three twisted flames reflected in the bowl appeared in his irises. Only sometimes there were two in one eye and only one in the other, or three in one and none in the other, or three in both and then blackness.
"No,"
whispered Adam. His voice sounded unlike his own. Blue was reminded terribly of the night she had stumbled upon Neve scrying in the roots of the beech tree. Again Blue looked to Calla. Again Calla remained still and watchful.
"Mara?"
Adam called.
"Mara?"
Only it was Persephone's voice coming out of Adam's mouth. "I can't do this," Blue thought suddenly. Her heart couldn't manage it, being afraid. Calla's other hand reached across the table to take Blue's.
They were joined in a circle around the scrying bowl. Adam's breathing hitched and slowed. Not again. Blue felt Calla's body shifting as she gripped Adam's hand tighter. No, he said again, and this was his own voice. The flames were huge in his eyes. Then they went back to black. He didn't breathe. The room was silent for one beat. Two beats. Three beats. The candles went out in the scrying bowl. Persephone! He shouted. Now, Calla said, releasing Blue's hand. Let go of him. Blue released his hand, but nothing happened. Cut him off, Calla snarled. I know you can. I'll pull him back. As Calla used her free hand to press a thumb to the center of Adam's forehead, Blue frantically imagined what she had done to pull the plug on Noah back in Monmouth. Only it had been one thing to do it while Noah threw things about. It was another thing to do it as she watched Adam's still chest and his empty eyes. Another thing as his shoulders sagged and his face fell into Calla's waiting hands just before he slumped into the scrying bowl. He's trusting us. He never trusts anyone, and he's trusting us. He's trusting you, Blue. She jumped out of her chair and put up her walls. She tried to visualize the white light pouring down to strengthen them, but it was hard when she could see Adam's body sprawled limply across the end of the reading table. Calla slapped his face. Come on, you bastard, remember your body. Blue turned her back on the scene. She closed her eyes, and she did it. There was silence. Then the overhead lights came on, and Adam's voice said, She's here. Blue spun.
What do you mean, here? Calla demanded.
Here, Adam said. He shoved out of his chair. Upstairs.
But we checked her room, Calla said.
Not in her room, Adam waved a hand impatiently. The highest. Where's the highest place? The attic, Blue said. Why would she be up there? Gwendolyn?
Gwendolyn's in the tree in the backyard, Calla said. She's singing at some birds who hate her.
Are there mirrors? Adam asked. Some place she would go to look for Mora? Calla swore. She tore open the attic door and charged up first, Blue and Adam close on her heels. At the top of the stairs, she said, No. Blue jumped past her. In between Neve's two mirrors was a pile of lace, canvas, and Persephone. Adam hurried forward, but Calla seized his arm.
No, you idiot! You can't reach between them. Blue, stop!
I can, Blue replied. She slid to kneel beside Persephone. She was collapsed in a way that was clearly unintentional. She was on her knees with her arms bent behind her and her chin hitched up, caught on the feet of one of the mirrors. Her black eyes stared into nothing. We'll get her back, Adam said, but Calla was already crying. Blue, unconcerned with dignity, dragged Persephone out by her armpits. She was light and unresisting. They would pull her back, just as Adam said. Calla sank to her knees and covered her face. Stop it, snapped Blue, voice cracking. Get over here and help. She took Persephone's hand. It was as cold as the cave walls. Adam stood with his arms wrapped around himself, a question in his eyes. Blue already knew the answer, but she couldn't say it. Calla did.
She's dead.
42. Blue had never believed in death until then. Not in a real way. It happened to other people, other families, and other places. It happened in hospitals or automobile crashes or battle zones. It happened, now she remembered Gansey's words outside Gwendolyn's tomb, with ceremony, with some announcement of itself. It didn't just happen in the attic on a sunny day while she was sitting in the reading room. It didn't just happen in only a moment, an irreversible moment. It didn't happen to people she had always known. But it did. And there would now forever be two Blues. The Blue that was before, and the Blue that was after. The one who didn't believe, and the one who did. 43. Ganzi arrived at 300 Fox Way after the ambulance had left, not because of a lack of haste, but because of a lack of communication. It took 24 calls from Adam to Ronan's cell phone before Ronan could be persuaded to pick up, and then it took Ronan a bit of doing to track down Ganzi on campus. Mallory was still out and about with a dog somewhere, prowling Virginia in the suburban, but he would be fine not knowing for a while. Persephone was dead. Ganzi couldn't believe it, not because he could not believe in the nearness of death. He could not stop believing in the nearness of death, but because he would not have expected Persephone to do something as mortal as dying. There had been something immutable about the three women in 300 Fox Way. Mora, Persephone, and Calla were the trunk from which all of the branches sprang. We must find Mora, he thought, as he climbed from the Camaro and started up the walk, Ronan dogging his steps with his hands shoved in pockets, chainsaw flapping grimly from branch to branch to follow. Because if Persephone can die, there's nothing to stop Mora from dying, too. Adam sat on the dappled shade of the front step, eyes blank, a wrinkle between his eyebrows. Ganzi's mother used to press her thumb to that place between Richard Ganzi III's brows and rub the frown out. She still did it to Ganzi II. He felt the urge to do it now as Adam tipped his face up. I found her, Adam said, and it didn't do any good at all. He needed Ganzi to say it was all right, and even though it was not all right, Ganzi found his voice and said, You did your best. Calla told me on the phone. She's proud of you. It's not going to feel any better now, Parrish. Don't expect it to. Adam freed, nodded miserably, and looked at his feet. Where's Blue? Adam blinked. He clearly didn't know. I'm going in, Ganzi said as Ronan sat down on the step beside Adam. As Ganzi shut the door behind him, he heard Adam say, I don't want to talk. And Ronan replied, The fuck would I talk about? He found Calla and Jimmy and Orla and two other young women he didn't recognize in the kitchen. Ganzi had meant to begin with, I'm sorry for your loss, or something polite, something that would make sense outside of this kitchen, but in this context, all of it felt more false than usual. Instead, he said, I'm going into the cave. We are. It was impossible, but it didn't much matter. Everything was impossible. He waited for Calla to say that it was a bad idea, but she didn't. A small part of him still wished that she would, the part that could feel small legs crawling over the back of his neck. Coward. He had spent a long time learning to put that in the back of his mind, and he did it now.
I'm going with you, Calla said, her knuckles tight around a glass. Enough of this flying solo nonsense. I'm so angry I could...
She hurled the glass to the kitchen floor. It splintered at Orla's feet. Orla stared at it, and then at Ganzi, her expression apologetic, but Ganzi had lived with Ronan's grief for long enough to recognize it.
There, Calla shouted. That's what it's like. Just destroyed for no purpose.
I'll get a vacuum, Jimmy said. I'll get a Valium, Orla said.
Calla stormed into the backyard. Ganzi retreated and crept up the stairs to the phone-sewing cat room. It was the only place he'd been on the second floor and the only other place he knew to look for Blue. She was not in there, though, nor in the adjacent room that was clearly her bedroom. He found her instead in a room at the end of the hall that seemed to be Persephone's. It smelled like her, and everything was odd and clever in it. Blue sat beside the bed, chipping aggressively at the polish on her nails. She looked up at him. The afternoon sunlight came in sharp and strong to land on the side of the mattress behind her, causing her to squint. That took forever, she said. My phone was off, I'm sorry. She chipped another bit of polish onto the shaggy rug. I guess there was no point to hurrying anyway. Ah, Blue. Is Mr. Gray here? She asked. I didn't see him. Look. I told Calla we were going into the cave to find Mora, he corrected more formally. Your mother. Oh, seriously, don't Richard Ganzi on me, Blue snapped, and then at once she began to cry. It was against the rules, but Ganzi crouched down beside her, one of his knees against her back, one against her knees, and hugged her. She curled against him, hands balled up against his chest.
He felt a hot tear slip into the dip of his collarbone. He closed his eyes against the sun through the window, burning hot in his sweater, foot falling asleep, elbow grinding into the metal bed frame. Blue Sergeant pressed up against him, and he didn't move. Help, he thought. He remembered Gwentleyan saying that it was starting and he could feel it winding out faster and faster, a ball of thread caught in the wind. Starting, starting. He could not tell who was comforting whom. I'm part of the useless new generation, Blue said finally, the words right on his skin. Desire and dread lay right next to each other in his heart, each sharpening the other. The computer generation. I keep thinking that I can hit the reset button, restart things. He pulled back, wincing through pins and needles, and gave her a mint leaf before sitting back against the bed frame beside her. When he looked up, he realized that Gwentleyan stood in the doorway. It was impossible to say how long she'd been there, her arms stretched up above her to the door frame as if she was trying to keep from being pushed into the room. She waited until she was sure Gansey was looking, then she sang, Queens and kings, kings and queens, blue lily, lily blue, crowns and birds, swords and things, blue lily, lily blue. Are you trying to make me angry? He asked.
Are you angry, Nightling?
Gwentleyan replied sweetly.
She leaned her cheek on her arm, rocking back and forth.
I used to dream of death. I had sung every song I knew so many times while I lay in that box on my face.
Every eye I could reach, I asked to look for me. And what did I get but stupidity and blindness?
How did you use other people's eyes if you're just like me? Blue asked. If you don't have any psychic powers of your own. Gwentleyan's mouth hung in the most dismissive shape possible.
This question. It is like asking how you can smash a nail if you are not a hammer.
Whatever, Blue said. It doesn't matter. I don't really care.
Artemis taught me. Gwentleyan said,
when he wasn't working 1, 2, 3, 4, my father. Here's a riddle, my love. My love, my love, what grows? My love, my love, my love, from dark. My love, my love, my love, too dark. My love, my love, my love.
Blue pushed angrily to her feet. No more games.
A tree at night, Gansey said. Gwentleyan stopped rocking on her arms and studied him where he still sat on the floor.
Much of my father, she replied. Much of my father in you. That is Artemis, the tree at night. Your mother looks for him, Blue Lily? Well, then you should seek my father. Artemis will be as near to him as he is able unless something prevents him. The better to whisper.
She spit on the floorboards by Gansey. I am seeking him, Gansey said. We're going underground.
Order me to do something for you, little prince boy, she told Gansey. Let's see your king metal.
Is that how your father convinced people to do things for him? He asked.
No, Gwentleyan said and looked annoyed about it.
He asked them.
Even through all of this wrongness, this impossibility, this warmed Gansey. This was right. Glendower should have ruled by request, not by command. This was the king he sought. Will you go with us? He asked.
44. When Colin Greenmantle went out onto the porch of the historic farmhouse and looked down at the field below, he discovered a herd of cows standing far away and two young men standing very close. It was, in fact, Adam Parrish
and Ronan Lynch. He looked down at them. They looked up. Neither party said anything. Both of the boys were unsettling. Adam Parrish, in particular, had a curious face. Not as in he was a curious person, but rather that there was something peculiar about his facial features. He was an alien, handsome specimen of this Western Virginia species. Feather-boned, hollow-cheeked, eyebrows fair and barely visible. He was spheral and raw-boned by way of those Civil War portraits. Brother fought brother while their farms ran to ruins. And Ronan Lynch looked like Neo Lynch, which was to say he looked like an asshole. Oh, youth. So Greenmantle broke the ice. He called down, "Are you turning in your exercises?" They continued standing there, looking like a pair of horror movie twins, one dark, one light. Adam Parrish smiled a little. It took 2 years off his age in a second. He had teeth on both his top and bottom jaw. "I know what you are." This was interesting. "And what am I?"
"Don't you know?"
Adam Parrish asked it with bland insouciance. Greenmantle narrowed his eyes. "Are we playing a game, Mr. Parrish?"
"Possibly."
Games, at least, were one of Greenmantle's specialties. He leaned against the railing. "In that case, I know what you are, too." Ronan Lynch handed Adam Parrish an oversized, bulging manila envelope.
"Oh, I don't think you do," Adam replied.
Greenmantle disliked the fearlessness in his face. It was not even fearlessness. It was a lack of expression entirely. He wondered what was in the envelope. Confessions of a teen sociopath. He said, "Do you know what keeps poor people down, Mr. Parrish? It's not a lack of income. It's a poverty of imagination. The trailer park dreams of the suburbs, and the suburbs dreams of the city. The city dreams of the stars, so on and so forth. The poor can imagine the throne, but not being kingly. Poverty of imagination. But you are a cuckoo who sneaks into this nest. You are Mr. Adam Parrish of 21 Antietam Lane, Henrietta, Virginia, and you have a good imagination, but you are a pretender nonetheless." The kid was good. The skin around his eyes tightened only a tiny bit when Greenmantle read off the trailer park's address. "And it would be so easy to hurl you to the ground from this tree," Greenmantle said in case he wasn't nervous yet. "You would long for those days in your trailer park." Adam Parrish looked at him. Greenmantle realized all at once that he was unsettling in the same way that Piper had been when he caught her looking in the mirror. Adam turned the bulging envelope around so that Greenmantle could see that it was seeping something red-brown, which was never a good sign. He said, "If you're not out of Henrietta by Friday, everything in that envelope comes true." Ronan Lynch smiled then, too, and it was a weapon. They left the envelope there. "Piper!" Greenmantle called after they had gone, but she didn't answer. It was impossible to know if she was there, but in a trance, or if she was gone, hunting for the thing that she heard humming in mirrors. This place, this damn place, they could have it. He climbed down the stairs finally and managed to find a door that led outside. He opened the envelope. The seeping was from a rotting, severed hand. It was small. A child's hand. Beneath it was a sealed plastic bag smeared with gore containing paperwork and photographs. Individually, they were distasteful. Collectively, they were damning. The envelope contents told a story of Colin Greenmantle, intellectual mass murderer and habitual pervert. It provided evidence of where the bodies and parts of bodies could be found. There were screenshots of condemning texts and cell phone photos, and when Greenmantle swiped up his real phone, he discovered that somehow they actually were on his phone in all their gruesome glory.
There were letters, homemade DVDs, photographs, a mountain of evidence. None of it was true. All of it had been dreamt up. But it didn't matter. It looked true. Truer than the truth. The Grey Warren was real. And those two boys had it. But it didn't matter because they were untouchable and they knew it. Damn youth. On the very bottom of the stack of filth was a single piece of paper with handwriting so similar to Neil Lynch's that it could only belong to his son. It said, Cui facit per alium facit per se. Greenmantle knew the proverb. He who does a thing by the agency of another does it himself.
45.
Okay, we're going, Greenmantle said. Family emergency. Back to Boston. Pack your things. Call your friends. You're off the hook for that book club book.
Piper was getting her purse. No, I'm going out with the men.
The men?
Yes, Piper said. Does that horrible gray man drive a white car? One of those boy racer cars? You know, with the big wing on the back? It's supposed to demonstrate what a big member the driver has, because I feel like one of those has been following me. I mean, ha, more than usual, because please. She flipped her hair.
I don't want to talk about the gray man, Greenmantle said. I want to talk about your luggage.
I'm not packing. I think I've found something, Piper said. Greenmantle showed her the envelope. She was not as impressed as he had been. She said, Oh, please, if I find what I think I'm finding, making that go away will be children's play. No pun intended. Oh, that was distasteful. She laughed. Okay, I'm out.
With the men. Greenmantle got up. I'll come with you. I'll convince you to come back with me along the way.
There was no chance Piper was finding something to counteract that envelope. The only thing Piper could find was fad exercise classes and hairless dogs. Whatever, put on some boots.
Piper's destination for that night involved meeting up with two thugs Greenmantle had hired. Actually, they were not as thuggish as Greenmantle would have expected. One of the men was named Morris, and a problem with alimony had driven him to a life of crime. The other seemed to be named Beast, and while actually he was exactly as thuggish as Greenmantle had expected, they both treated Piper as if she knew what she was talking about.
Show me what you got, Piper said to them.
Morris and Beast led them to a rundown farm just as the sun set. Even in the car lights, it was easy to tell that the farmhouse had seen better days. The porch sagged. Someone had tried to improve it by planting a cheery row of flowers in front. Beast and Morris led them past the farmhouse and through a field. They had all kinds of equipment. Piper had all kinds of equipment. Greenmantle had boots. He felt like a fourth wheel on a vehicle that was not, in fact, meant to have four wheels.
He looked over his shoulder to make sure that the gray man, ever standing over his shoulder, was not, in fact, standing just over it.
I am not experienced with practical crime, Greenmantle said as they walked across the field. But shouldn't we have parked the car someplace more clandestine? He added, sneakier?
For Beast.
No one lives there, grunted Beast.
Greenmantle was both horrified and impressed by the subsonic nature of his voice. Morris, considerably more cultured sounding, added, We were here earlier checking it out. The two men, thugs, the thug and Morris, brought them to a stone building. Greenmantle thought it didn't have a roof, but then after a second his eyes adjusted and he saw that it was a stone tower extending up into the night. He wasn't sure why he thought it was a ruin at first. He wasn't sure why a tower like this would exist in the middle of redneck Virginia either, but it was interesting at least, and he liked interesting.
The cave's in here, said Morris.
There was a padlock on the door, but it had already been busted open, presumably by Beast's molars.
And this cave seems to match the description I gave you, Piper asked.
Why do you have a description of a cave?
Greenmantle asked.
Shut up before you hurt yourself, she told him kindly.
Yeah, Morris said. I didn't see any doors like you described, but we didn't go very far in.
He pushed open the door as Beast turned on a massive spotlight. It illuminated an enormous man sitting at the cave entrance. He had a shotgun lying across his knees.
I'm telling you now that this cave is cursed, the man told them, and I think you best go now. Short ways across the field.